Today's episode is sponsored by Koroz. Koroz is the leading customer engagement platform. From social media to online communities to digital customer care, Koroz helps companies authentically connect with customers. Koroz connects consumer insights across departments and helps companies run their businesses with their customers, anticipating their needs and accelerating sales. Koroz works with over 2,000 brands, including 52 of the Interbrand 100 companies, and powers over 500 million digital interactions every day. Check them out at koroz.com. That's K-H-O-R-O-S.com. Hello and welcome to the Shiny New Object podcast. My name is Tom Ollerton. I'm the founder of Automated Creative, and this podcast is about the future of marketing. Every week or so, I have the pleasure and the privilege of interviewing one of our industry's leaders. And this week, I'm excited to say, is no different. I'm on a call with Catherine Freely, who is Global Marketing IMC Associate Director at Colgate-Palmolive. Catherine, for those who are listening to this podcast who don't know who you are or what you do, can you give a bit of an introduction to yourself?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Tom. So as Tom said, my name is Catherine Freely, and I have been with Colgate-Palmolive now for 12 years in my role with global marketing. But previously to Colgate, I've had an over 10-year career in media planning, strategy, and buying with all the advertising agencies like WPP and Publicis and IPG. So one can say that media and marketing has been my life, professional life so far. And, I really am very passionate about media world and marketing world and the new shiny objects in our marketing world. So thank you, Tom, for having me here to speak at your podcast.
No, thank you. It's brilliant. Okay, what an impressive career. I look forward to digging into that a bit later. But first of all, we're going to get to know you a little bit. So a couple of quick questions. Are you a marketing book person? Do you read marketing books? And if you do,
which
is your favorite?
I've loved a lot of marketing books, but I just rediscovered this little book called Love is a Killer App by Tim Sanders, and he was a former Yahoo executive. And it's like one of those books that I found in like our, closet that everybody leaves the books in the office. And I picked up the book and I said, wow, what a great book that is. And it was a New York Times bestseller back in like 2003. But what I loved about this book is like it talked about human relevance and not human, but brand relevance and connections and distinctive attributes and return on attention. And I was saying to my, and compassion and empathy and being human. I really like this about this book because it's a short read, but it really is something that allows you to truly understand how marketing those days should be done and can be done to be a successful brand in 2020 and beyond. So I really love that book and I truly recommend it to everybody.
And what would you say is the two or three key insights that you've taken from that book that you use on a regular basis?
Yeah, so especially, that right now it's all about the connections that you make with your customers and consumers and about just being different, right? The distinctive attributes, like how in the clutter environment, how are you different as a brand? How are you talking and connecting with your consumers in a different way? And also, about the storytelling, like we're now all about storytelling at Colgate, and that's what we want our creative to be. So there were just like those few tidbits in that book that, it was written almost more than 10 years ago, and they're so relevant right now for how we approach marketing. So I thought that was really cool and interesting, just a short read. I love short reads.
So there's some great advice there, but what are the bad recommendations that you hear in the industry? What advice makes you roll your eyes and think, oh my life, what, tell me some of those kind of things to avoid.
Yes, I have a few of those since I've been in the industry for, you know, over two decades. So I think that, lately, what I think the bad recommendations are is like when we approach a project and somebody, like a project leader, is striving for perfection and they really want to get to all the use cases and all the, you know, users, and it takes them months. And I just say, you know, we really need to be more agile those days. And you know, the 80-20 rule, if you get to an 80 and you actually get that thing going, for people to actually use it and test it and provide you with feedback, like, to me, that is so much more important those days than taking like 7 to 8 months and come up with this perfect situation or recommendation, and then be a bit surprised that people might critique it or provide feedback, and you know, it isn't as perfect as one would think it is, and it takes a really long time to show it to either the users or, you know, even your bosses. So I'm more about Tom, those days about like agility and like not getting it all perfect, but really more optimize it as you go. And I think that this is a better approach towards, marketing and campaign and any projects that we do. And, as an all CPG, we obviously were all about perfection, and it did take us like a year to come up with a campaign. And I think that mindset changed those days about trying to get things, you know, faster, more like a startup, is really something I embrace.
So how do you know when you've done enough? I mean, you say 80-20. Okay, I buy that. And I love the idea of not being perfect and just getting it out there. But there's a gap, right, between not having done enough and having done just enough to get it in front of the audience or your boss or whoever. So do you have any tools or techniques or methods or hunches for when something is good enough to go?
Yeah, so it's a bit of, you know, I think it's practice makes a good predictor of when it's enough to, you know, start presenting to people. But I think that, you know, if you have like a full story, sort of like full story, not perfect story, but if it sort of hits on all the main objectives that you were supposed to deliver, then even if it's not, as I said, perfect, I think that you're good to go to start showing it to other people, and or whether it's bosses or users, to get their feedback, because it only can become more complete when you get, you know, actual points of views of either people that will sell it up or people that will use it, right? So you don't want to go too far and become too, like, fall too in love with your idea and then don't want to not be flexible enough to change it. But I think that it's just like, you know, you really have to specify your main objectives. And if you hit those, I would say that's like your good guide for when it's good enough.
And so how do you deal with people who are perfectionists? How do you talk people out of being a perfectionist? How have you managed to change someone's mind who previously just wanted to get it perfect?
Yeah, so that's not easy, because I think a perfectionist is a person that you either are or you are not, right? So a perfectionist will always try to come back to try to be perfect. I think as a leader of a project, you just have to really draw the line at some point and just start presenting it. So you can take all the feedback and all the notes up to a point, and at some point you just have to make an executive decision that this is good enough to either test or start presenting it up.
So moving away from some great advice there in terms of attitude and approach, let's look at actual stuff. What's the most useful thing that you've bought with your own money that you rely on for work?
Well, something very expensive, Tom. So I paid for my own doctorate. So I got a doctor of management degree with the University of Maryland. And I really it really did help me professionally. I don't use it, like, so I wanted to become a professor, but I didn't become a professor. I still stayed in marketing, working for Colgate. But my dissertation and just my work of study really did help me in my professional work. So my dissertation was on conflict management and about how to harness the constructive power of conflict. And to be completely frank with you, I do use it at work all the time, and it really has helped me tremendously. So even though it was really expensive and really painful, I do, when I reflect back, I really do find it as the most useful thing that I
Right,
have spent money on.
we're going to have to go deep here into conflict management and how, what did you say, conflict management and how to use it creatively or effectively? So,
Yeah, so it was like harnessing the power of constructive conflict management. That was something that, was my dissertation topic.
but so is someone listening to this podcast, I can hear them saying, I want to know more about this. So what are the three things to take away from using conflict management in a productive way?
Sure. So I think that the common belief is that conflict management is something very bad and destructive. And really, having done all the research, conflict can be actually a very constructive power. So don't be afraid of conflict, but manage it openly. Have a lot of point of views on the table, being able to be expressed. Don't have people be afraid of expressing their opinions, right? And just have an open work environment is really all the findings that I've had through doing my dissertation. But especially through expressing points of view, different points of view, is that's what really fuels creativity. So that is that creative power of conflict. Having everybody agree will not create, would not give you a great creativity. So I think that those are the three few takeaways from my entire dissertation.
So, in your career, what have you become better at saying no to?
That's a good question, Tom. Well, I think that when you're early in your career, it's very difficult to just start to say no. Just want to be like a yes person, please everybody. But when you become a bit of a more seasoned professional, I think that what you've learned that no sometimes is a good answer as well, just like a yes. And I think that what I've become much better at is saying no to projects that like have no added value to the entire process or a bigger project that you manage. But they're just projects that like your boss wants you to do or somebody else wants you to do just for no reason. And I think that when I see those projects those days, I'm much better of like, and you're not always can say no to your boss, right? That's a tricky situation. But I think I'm better at showing the case why I should not spend 5 days, 5 weeks on a project that might never see a light of a day, or it's really not useful for anybody, or take shortcuts to that project if I cannot completely say no to it. But I become better at identifying and building my case studies on why I should not be spending a lot of time on those projects, for example.
So, how do you say no to the things that you want to do? Because there's one thing your boss going, can you go and do this project for 5 weeks? And you're like, oh, and you can argue the point using the case studies, which I think is an interesting way. But what I suffer from is I see something like a shiny new object, for example, and I go, oh my God, I really want to do that thing. And I'll get dragged into, I drag myself into it. And sometimes I get caught up with the exciting thing as opposed to the right thing. So do you suffer from that? And if you do, how do you deal with it?
I do because I'm quite a passionate person. You know, I've had a passion for marketing for many years. So I got really excited about things. And then I put my energy into something. And that something might not be exactly, you know, what is my objective for my work. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's like you have to prioritize and you have to drag yourself from something that, you know, you want to do, but you know that that's not exactly your objective. So I think it's just a little bit of self-discipline and looking back to really what you are supposed to achieve it's not nice. Like my son wants to watch TV or play video games and I have to tell him no. And he's not happy with me. But at the end of the day, you know, it's just the same sort of approach that you have to do for yourself. It's like, I know you want to do that because that's sort of your video game addiction and you love it. But I really have to do the contract negotiation, which I really don't like so much. So I think it's a bit of, how you try not to eat candy every day.
I love that you describe the internal mind as a young teenager playing computer games. That's a really interesting way of describing it, and it makes total sense. So
I just thought that, you know, like when those kids or teenagers love it, they really love it. So I think it's why I was trying to really describe that passionate approach to something and trying to take yourself away from it.
So what new belief or behaviors have you taken on board in the last few years that have had a big impact on your work life?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this is sort of, I didn't take it on voluntarily, but my daughter started to, as a new school, a middle school in Manhattan. And, you know, I started to commute with her like earlier. So I started to come into the office at 8 a.m. versus 9 a.m., and I have found that this is that hour between 8 and 9 when everybody else gets into the office is like the best, the most creative hour of my day. When, you know, if I want to do a presentation or if I want to think conceptually or I really want to do a concept map of something, that's like my best time of my day, or prepare for a presentation, you know, something that's really difficult, right? So that to me, like that 1 hour in the morning, and you know, everybody is different. Some people loved that hour to be maybe 11, 12 p.m. I like it 8 to 9 a.m. But finding that extra hour in your day when you're most creative or open to new ideas, I think is something that, you know, I would say have really helped me the past few years.
And so can I just jump back to something you said? You work on a concept map. Is that the phrase you used?
Yeah.
Or what's that?
The concept map is especially helpful. I think this is something that I picked up doing my dissertation. It's when you have a more of an abstract idea or a concept, right? And especially it's great with like strategy development. When you don't exactly know what it is, you just start drawing boxes, connecting with arrows, and you just create a concept map. And of course, you can change it many, many, many times. It's like a conceptual model of a more abstract construct. But it's sometimes very helpful to bring it down to people, whether your managers or your bosses or even people you manage, if you want to break it down of something that's a little bit more conceptual that they might not be able to wrap their heads around it.
If you love all things innovation and want to understand how brands plan to emerge stronger from the current situation, don't forget to check out Madfest London on the 11th and 12th of November. My good friend Dan at Madfest knows how to put on a cracking event, and there's always plenty of amazing speakers, beer and cool people to meet. Check it out at www.madfestlondon.com. So we're kind of getting up to the halfway point now. So Thanks for giving us that insight into how you do what you do. But we're going to talk about your shiny new object, which is humanity in an AI world. And when you told me this, when we spoke the other week, I was like, I can't wait to talk about this. I think I know what you mean, but could you explain to the audience what you see humanity in an AI world as being? Help them understand it simply.
Yeah. I will try. At least I think what I've noticed is that, you know, artificial intelligence intelligence, AI, right, is, in my opinion, an extremely powerful new force that is entering not only marketing, but marketing as well, but our world altogether. And I think that, you know, the problem and the struggle that humanity will have, AI is extremely smart, and it probably can do a lot of things better than humans can. So, and even with functions like, you know, functions that I would have never thought that AI can actually do, but like creative development, it actually can do it very well. So when I was thinking about the shiny new object, to me, I was thinking about what does the humanity, how the humanity can actually, you know, carve out their own point of difference against the artificial intelligence, right? And I truly think that the way that the humanity will survive and can survive in the future is, you know, something that the book that I recommended earlier, Love is Killer App, talks about. And really what it is, you know, that you as a, it's like knowledge, but knowledge more from the heart and emotions-driven knowledge and human truths is something that will you know, differentiate us from artificial intelligence, because artificial intelligence can have a lot of knowledge, but that's a human knowledge. It's a different type of knowledge. Also networks, but more of like developing human relationships and networks is something that can, you know, differentiate us from AI, because it's also, you know, artificial intelligence can be great, you know, at networks. And then I think the last, that killer app that artificial intelligence will not have for a foreseeable future is the compassion and empathy, very deep human emotions, right, that we have. And this is actually something that I think we should build on more and more as we go into this world of technologies, artificial intelligence, high-level computing. You know, our brains are great computers, but they cannot be compared with, you know, artificial intelligence. But what is better, and what artificial intelligence does not have, is that compassion, that empathy, that, you know, touch, that eye movement, something that we humans can do, which AI cannot do. And I think that that's what we should really concentrate on as humans, discovering those old truths that at some point, you know, we're a little bit lost in the business world, because in the business world, you were supposed to be all about, intelligence, all about the numbers, all about, you know, what a great attribute your product had, right? Why is it more powerful? Why does it clean teeth so much better than my competitors' brands? It was all about numbers, products, benefits. As right now, even us, you know, Colgate, we look at how do we do marketing by impactful storytelling, connecting with consumers through the human truths. How do you find those insights that actually differentiate you from your competitors? How do you become a brand that really makes a point of difference, right? So, you know, I think that that's what humanity, artificial intelligence world needs, is the true human connections that we only the humans can do. And tying it back to marketing, you know, we can actually put them in the very enticing storytelling and connecting with our consumers that way versus trying to crunch numbers, look at the research, just look at, you know, quants. Even when I was doing my dissertation, you know, I always looked into a qualitative research. In I didn't discount it. I actually liked it a lot, because to me, there was discovering more truths, the qualitative research methodologies versus crunching numbers and saying that that number rules it all because it came out of some kind of a great model that I was able to construct. So, you know, I think, Tom, that to me, But to me, the humanity in the AI-driven world is, that's what it's all about. It goes back to our main traits as humans that differentiate us from the machines.
So many things there I want to get into. So right at the start, you said that the listeners of this podcast would be surprised by what AI is capable of in terms of creative development. Can you give us some illustration of that?
Yeah, so, you know, I always thought that machines cannot create, do creative, right? But they can, and they can probably do as good creative as all the agencies that we employ and a lot of the creative directors that we employ, because at the end of the day, you know, they can especially create those ads or online content that is very much like conversion driven, right? If you tell the AI that you want to hit a couple of objectives that you have, you can create a great algorithm, right, that will create you those ads, those online banners, those online videos. I think that that's what a surprising factor to me is of AI also being able to look at target audiences and differentiate between different target audiences, and again, you know, create those ads or those banners and online videos based on those audiences that you would basically describe to the artificial intelligence. So I think that, you know, those are some kind of new things or surprising things to me that when I started to think about it, is that the AI can be actually great at creating those ads that we strive for, especially in the digital era, right? Where we want to have multiple pieces of content or multiple pieces of creative content that would be targeting completely different target audience. And I think that that's, you know, once you identified some of those human truths by humans, that I still think has to be done by humans, you can then feed that in a great algorithm, the AI, that they can then can really create great creatives based on those insights.
So let's focus a little more on the interaction between the human and the machine. I think what you've described there is creative production, you know, different ads for different people at different times on different platforms, different audiences. But you said that the human truth or the humanity needs to come from a human being. Do you think that will always be the case? Have you seen any technologies or processes that have enabled machines to push into a more empathetic area?
I have not seen that as of yet, but when I was thinking about this podcast, Tom, I wanted to say that one of the things that humans are better at than machines is like the nonverbal communication. And then I have realized that that's not exactly true. Because I just recently went to the spy museum in New York City, and you know, they have this test on how good of a spy you are. And actually the machine reads all your nonverbal clues, right? And they tell you how many times you've lied or, you know, you've answered something, you know, in an untruthful manner. And, you know, that machine, that computer was quite right. And it did it all based on the nonverbal clues. So, you know, so how I winked, or I smiled, or I made a face, right? Or I twitched. So then I started to think, oh my goodness, you know, machines are very close to actually read the emotion. Or nonverbal communication, right? That we always said really differentiates the humans from the machines. What I don't know if the machines can do yet, and I have not seen this as of yet, is truly have empathy or the true deep compassion towards other people. There's perhaps, you know, some very basic directives that an AI or a machine can be given, like for example, if the machine, if the computer sees somebody crying, the answer can be, you know, more empathetic, the tone of voice, right? Like all those bots that we get phone calls from. I mean, they became quite humanoid. So there is a level, I think, of clues that a machine can be given to become a little bit more empathetic. But I think that the real deep compassion and empathy, that I don't see machines being able to have.
Do you think machines need to be empathetic or just appear to be empathetic?
I think machines cannot be truly empathetic. I think the difference is that machines will appear to be empathetic. I think that's the true difference between the machine and the humanity.
So, once again, we're running out of time, which is really annoying. But what I'm curious to know is that someone is listening to this podcast who works for a brand or a number of brands, and they're thinking, right, okay, there's humanity in an AI world is something that's necessary, and that's our humanity is our role in a world where machines can do all kinds of different things. So how do we start being good at that? What are the steps that we can take to leveling up our humanity in a marketing context? That's a very bad sentence. But like, what are the skills we need to develop in the next 5 years to make sure that we are best placed to work alongside the brilliant machines that you describe?
Right. So I think, you know, don't just rely on numbers all the time, research, quantitative research, but really look to yourself for the human, you know, truths, right? The true emotions that you have, and how do you actually as a human being connect with other people? And I think that if we as a humanity will cultivate our human side, that will actually enable us to work better as brand stewards and coexist with the artificial intelligence computers and machines, as we will have to in the next 5 years, but really truly developing, you know, those skills as humans that will then help us to connect with our consumers better, to create better stories, to connect with our consumers better, to better steward our brands, to have a point of difference, you know, in this world where everybody's, you know, fighting for attention. I think that if we concentrate on those like really basic human truths, what makes us actually human is we'll become better marketers, we'll become better brand stewards, you know, and we will, I think, know how to work with AI in a more partner-like basis.
So how do you think we should measure this? Because working in the field that my business does, we use this kind of technology to make ads. This podcast is not about my business. Mm-hmm. But the problem that we come up against a lot is that you're looking to understand an audience and you're looking to empathize with an audience by working at this huge speed and scale with these types of technologies. But fundamentally, the measures for understanding the audience are so coarse. So click-through rate, cost per click, CPA. How do you see the industry crossing the gap between what you're talking about, which is being more empathetic, honing our human skills to work alongside computers, and yet you have these machines that can only really report back on the metrics that Google provide or Facebook provide or your email service provides, which are coarse and unemotional?
Yeah. So, I mean, the measurement world is far away from being perfect, right? I think at the end of the day is connecting all those imperfect measures to your business results. So if this is a creative that was done by AI and it drives your business, I think at the end of the day, is a good creative. if that was a creative that was done by, let's say, your agency full of human beings, and that creative did not drive your business, so whatever your business metric is it sales, is it net sales, is it brand impact, is it brand recall, right? We all have different measures. But at the end of the day, it is sales. If we don't grow as businesses, now we talk, I'm talking completely business-like, if we don't grow our sales, grow our market share, then we don't do our job properly. So I think at the end of the day, it's something, you know, that can be connected at a very at a higher level and a very practical level. You know, is this, you know, if this is my business growth metrics, you know, is this creative driving it or not driving it? And if it's driving, then whether it's AI or human creative, you know, that is a good creative. That's the creative I want to create more of, versus, you know, the one that's not driving is just something that wasn't good for me and for my growth as a brand. So I think at the end of the day, you know, the measurement is extremely imperfect in our advertising world. But I think that I just would like to level set the measurement for everything in the advertising world has never been perfect, right? So with the artificial intelligence or computing, we're getting to a bit of a better indication of what works and what doesn't. But, you know, sometimes I still think that Ogilvy's words of, 50% of advertising money is wasted, which we just don't know which one, still sort of stands true, whether we have the computers or not. So, you know, I think that we have to, as advertisers and marketers, just describe your business objectives the right way and try to see if we can somehow connect this to how our creative is driving those objectives.
Catherine, we're going to have to leave it there. Annoyingly, so many more questions I have for you, but maybe another time. So
maybe
if anyone who's listening to this podcast wants to get in touch with you, how would you like them to do that?
So I think the best is to probably use my email, which is Freely, like my last name, K, like the initial of my first name, at gmail.com.
Fantastic. And if someone was going to write to you on your email, what would make a brilliant email that you'd reply to?
You know, I'm not I don't discriminate. I think from people that would have questions to me, I would probably reply to most of the emails. So please send me an email if you're interested in anything I was talking about.
Brilliant. What an offer. What a lucky bunch of listeners this podcast has. Catherine, thank you so much. That was a real treat.
Thank you, Tom.